This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. 7 years ago at this time, the Gulf Coast was facing a different kind of crisis, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The crippled wellhead spewed nearly 10,000 tons of oil and natural gas each day for 3 months. Fairly early in the crisis, officials made an unprecedented and highly controversial decision to inject chemical dispersants at the wellhead to break up the oil and gas and reduce the amount that made it to the surface and subsequently onto beaches and wildlife. Over the course of 67 days, more than 700,000 gallons of chemical dispersants were injected at the wellhead. Now, a new study finds that that decision likely reduced the amount of toxic petroleum chemicals in the air, making working conditions for those tracking and cleaning up the spill significantly less dangerous. Chris Reddy is a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was deeply involved in the response to the Gulf oil spill, and he's one of the authors of that new study. Chris, I hate to be impertinent, but that was 7 years ago. What took you guys so long?
Well, science takes a long time. You know, unfortunately, we're not like the TV shows where CSI, where we can slam dunk everything in 59 minutes with 99% certainty.
So. All right. So take us back to 2010.
Yes.
And this decision that was made to use chemical dispersants, what were the arguments in favor and what were the concerns?
Well, it was unprecedented. I mean, everything about the Deepwater Horizon was unprecedented. But in this case, the idea of concept of, you know, anytime we're adding chemicals to a chemical spill is always of concern. But in this case, it was uncharted waters. You know, it was a decision made by folks who had been thinking about using dispersants their whole careers. And, you know, they rolled the dice and they had anecdotal evidence that it was working. But nobody set up a really well-defined scientific project to check that.
That to me is amazing, right? This was such a controversial decision.
Yeah.
There was a lot of science going on. You were down there. There were lots of scientists down there tracking the oil. Why wasn't there a concerted effort to look at the effects of the dispersants?
Unfortunately, the academic component, which was a strong component, was, you know, in the way that the science works in the United States government, was everybody was interested in what they thought was interesting. And unfortunately, which is now better now, the folks who are running the spill were not putting out questions that could be useful to them. So there was a lack of communication of somebody saying, hey, we're going to do this. Does anybody want to do research on this? So there was an absence of communication between the response community and the academic community. This is better now in the last 7 years, but that's one, you know, big gap. The other gap is, you know, I always think about oil spills as more like firefighting. And, you know, you have to make decisions about fighting a fire, about stopping the house, one house catching on fire, then the whole neighborhood. And the last thing you need is a scientist getting in the middle of the firefighters and asking if they can put a test tube down. So there is a certain balance between, okay, we're in there, we're trying to make a bad thing from getting worse, and we're going to use our best knowledge, and that's just it. And unfortunately, it would have been nice to have a little bit more data to prove this, because now in hindsight, it is a highly polarized topic.
So what you've done at this point is, instead of just using empirical data from that summer, is to create a mathematical computer model of the oil spill and then simulate the perfect experiment, the oil spill with the dispersants and the oil spill without the dispersants. How do you do that, though, if the data wasn't collected in the first place? You've got to be using some data. So what data are you using?
Yes, we do. We have data. We actually have data that I collected in June that helps us ground truth.
June of 2010.
2010 that helps ground truth what was in the water column, what was in the water. And just by chance, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration had a fantastic atmospheric chemist, a guy named Tom Ryerson, who was flying over the site with a plane that was tricked out to do atmospheric chemistry measurements at the same time, or roughly the same time. So we had enough data to essentially see what was in the water and what was in the air around the same time, and was able to marry that data and use that only to ground truth the results, but not calibrate the model. So we didn't trick the model. The model did the work, and then we tested to see if the data was within the bounds of what we saw in the real world. And that was kind of a little bit more, made this outcome a little bit more robust.
So the model did match pretty well with the real world data.
Yeah.
And found a pretty significant reduction in the amount of some of these petroleum chemicals in the air where you and lots of others were working that summer.
Yeah. I mean, I was one of the few scientists who was within. They had a 3-mile circle in which you could not get inside that circle. You have to remember that within a 3-mile circle around where the blowout occurred, where the rig caught on fire, there were sometimes up to 100 vessels. And so you can figure out
It was a 100-mile circus.
Yeah. So there was a lot of folks in there. And luckily, I got permission to be inside there a few times. And, the air quality sometimes was better in there.
How much better?
Significantly better. I mean, here I am. I almost use scientific jargon and it's orders of magnitude, but let's just say hundreds of times better. But it's for compounds that we worry about, like benzene and toluene, which are compounds that are very abundant in gasoline and other compounds that we worry about from a toxic perspective. And so that's the key point is that, a lot of chemicals were released from the well for over 87 days, but we wanted to think about the compounds that packed the biggest punch in terms of human health. And those were the compounds that we wanted to focus on. And that's what was the outcome.
I mean, a 30% reduction total in the amount of petroleum chemicals that were in the air. But for some of these, like you're mentioning, the most toxic ones, they were almost eliminated.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's the big point is that, every chemical has a different chemical behavior. And so although there was a reduction by 30% across the board, kind of in a bulk basis, some chemicals behave a little bit differently. And the ones that behave differently, that have a personality to stay and be dissolved in the water were the ones that were the most harmful. And so those ones were the ones that we reduced significantly, and which in turn allowed to have air quality be better.
Now, the flip side of that is that those chemicals didn't disappear. A dispersant doesn't eliminate them.
No.
It just means they stay
no.
in the water.
That's right. That's
right. And you were part of the team that found that there was this deep layer of petroleum chemicals and dispersant chemicals. 7 years later, what do we know about the environmental impact? I mean, that was one of the big concerns about using the dispersants.
That's right. I mean, there's always first we have to disentangle the dispersants that were applied on top of the surface, which has been done many times around the world. But no, there's always a trade-off using dispersants. Yeah, because we're not magically disappearing them. We're essentially re-warehousing them. We're just moving them from one warehouse to the other. And in this case, the outcome of using the subsurface dispersants is that we kept more in the water as opposed to the atmosphere. And the question that we asked a lot of biologists was that most of this was going to stay at about 3,000 feet that was going to be entrained instead of going up into the atmosphere and be breathed. And when we spoke to the biologists, although we don't have any data per se, but their thoughts were that the impacts of keeping it in the water were very small. And so in this case, the trade-off was valuable.
So if you had to go back to 2010, and if you were the one making this decision now with 7 years worth of data about the pros and the cons of having used the dispersants, would you advise officials to make the same decision to use the dispersants? Or would you say, no, maybe we should hold off?
Well, that's a great question, and that's the big question. And the question is, at the end of the day, what is the goal? So, there is a person who's in charge. It's usually a Coast Guard captain or admiral, and they're called the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. And they or he or she has to make a decision in coordination with others, about the use of dispersants and whether it's at the subsurface or above. And, now this result just goes into the calculus. There are trade-offs. In this case, this data supports that the air quality could be better. But the rest of the story has not really been filled in. And so, it's just a line on the ledger. It's just, this appears to be a positive side, But somebody has to go through, and thankfully the National Academy of Sciences is doing this as we speak and kind of thinking about, can you balance the books and see where's the positives and where's the negatives of using subsurface dispersants so that we can make it available and the knowledge base available so that the folks who have to make that decision can make that decision. So all I'm trying to do is trying to fine-tune one of the tools in the toolboxes.
That's Chris Reddy. He's an oil spill chemist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Chris, thanks so much. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you.